And welcome, everyone, to In Short Order. We are here today with somebody pretty famous, Dr. Michael Bruce. He's called the Sleep Doctor, and he is with us right now. Dr. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, wonderful, 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 wonderful. I am so happy. He's a clinical psychologist and is on the clinical advisory board of the Dr. Oz Show. We are honored to have you here. I am thrilled. We've got so many questions that were sent in and tons of people listening. A lot of people have trouble with sleep, don't they?
It's amazing, isn't it? I feel like I'm the most popular girl at the dance sometimes.
You are. You're the well, you know, most of the complaints I hear are sleep. Pain and sleep, the two things. So if we could, let's dive right in.
Sure.
How did you get in to be the sleep doctor? What led you to this?
Well, it was interesting. So when I was in graduate school, so I have a PhD, not an MD. I'm a board-certified clinical psychologist. But I'm also board certified in clinical sleep disorders. So I took the medical board without going to medical school and passed. I'm one of 163 psychologists who've ever done that. And I've been an actively practicing sleep doctor for almost 17 years now. But, you know, to reverse a little bit, when I was in graduate school, I was doing my residency, and I was actually interested in sports psychology primarily. And that part of the residency wasn't going to happen until the second half. So I had to find something to do for the first half. And there were a lot of different rotation options. And one of them was sleep. And I said, you know what, I'll give that a try. I don't know anything about it, but it sounds like fun. You know, who knows where it'll take me. And by the third day, I absolutely fell in love with clinical sleep medicine. It was amazing. I mean, I get the opportunity to help people in 48 hours. Like, my methods work so well and so fast sometimes that, you know, it's almost like I'm waving a magic wand. It's crazy.
No, it is absolutely the best type of medicine. You know, if we don't sleep, we can't heal. And we're going to talk
about that.
Yes, we had some questions. Do you want to take questions first, or do you want to get into the sleep first? Because we've had questions
come in.
The very first question was, can lack of sleep be responsible for depression?
So interesting. We're not clear. We know that it seems to be a two-way street. People who are depressed don't sleep well, and people who don't sleep well are depressed. So we can see this happening in both directions, and that can be a bit of a problem for many mm-hmm. people. You know, especially folks who are just not in general sleeping particularly well, that can really have a pretty major effect, and again cause a significant level of depression for them. But again, people with depression, you know, oftentimes are staying in bed and not getting great sleep. So it really can work in both directions.
Okay, terrific, fair enough. The next one was, I can't sleep. I've taken prescription supplements, teas, and nothing works. Why?
Well, I wish it were that easy, right? I wish I could just, you know through the radio what was going on with this person. You know, here's the thing, is the number one reason why I have people tell me that they can't sleep is because they can't turn off their brain at night. That is mm-hmm. a very, very common scenario. And so one of the first things I look at is, what is the level of anxiety that somebody might be experiencing before bed? And what are they? Could they be doing things themselves that could actually be having an effect, right? So as an example, are they having a very emotional discussion with their bed partner right before bed? Are they using devices that are high in blue light right before bed? Are they trying to pay their bills right before bed? I mean, you would be shocked at the number of things that can actually cause a level of anxiety right before bed that can absolutely affect your ability to fall asleep at night.
Wow. I never thought about that, but yeah. I always think of food. You know, when people eat things mm-hmm. that excite them, yeah, I think of that. You know, I always ask people, well, what are you eating a couple hours before you want to go to sleep? You know, or are we talking sugar? What are we talking here? But yeah, I never thought of that. Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at when you look at food. Interestingly enough, carbohydrates help with sleep. You know, not necessarily high sugar carbohydrates, but you know, the good carbs have been shown to actually help people increase the level of serotonin. And when you increase somebody's level of serotonin, that can actually help calm them down and get them to fall asleep.
Wow. Wow. Hope everyone out there is taking notes, because this is important stuff. And we all have trouble from time to time getting to sleep. I know even I do, and I sleep like a rock. But once in a while, I have trouble sleeping. And so, you know, I usually get up and read or something like that, and then I go right to sleep. But other people, it doesn't work for them. The next question is, I have nightmares and keep waking up. What can I do?
So nightmares are a very specific sleep disorder. There is an internet-based program by a Dr. Barry Krakow, K-R-A-K-O-W, out of the University of New Mexico. And it's an internet-based program. It works very, very well. But the basics behind it are, we actually have people write out everything that they can remember about their nightmare, every single aspect of it. So to the last detail. And then we have them change the ending. So instead of being the victim, they become the victor, right? And so what we have them do is, if you're being chased by somebody who's trying to kill you, then you get to chase that person and kill them, type of thing. And what we do is, once they change the ending, then we have them read it and repeat it to themselves over and over and over right before they fall asleep. And over the course of about 2 weeks, they actually end up changing the content of the dream itself, which is pretty amazing.
Right. And that's on the same line. It's Dr. Clancy McKenzie has programmed dreams. So I guess you can program your dreams that way as well, to get rid of the nightmares. How awesome is that? What causes sleepwalking? I wonder if that was from the same person.
We don't always know what causes sleepwalking. We know that the more sleep-deprived a person is, the greater likelihood they are to sleepwalk. We also know that there are some medications that can make people get involved with sleepwalking. Believe it or not, some of the sleep medications have been known to make people sleepwalk. So like the Ambien and the Lexapro of the world. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, and I think that is a side effect that they do list or something. Okay, and what is sleep apnea, and how does it affect sleep?
So sleep apnea is a very serious... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and isn't that involved with, like, snoring and weight and things like that, too?
It is.
Sleep apnea.
And so sleep apnea is a very serious medical disorder where, believe it or not, your throat collapses in the middle of the night, and you actually stop breathing in your sleep, which is obviously a very serious situation. You know, we like it when our patients breathe, right? That's a good thing.
Yeah, right. And
sometimes that can have to do with weight, but not all the time. Sometimes it can have to do with snoring, but not all the time. It's kind of interesting. Everybody I know that has sleep apnea snores, but not everybody who snores has sleep apnea, right? So roughly 50% of people in the United States, we think, are snorers, but only about, for men anyway, between 18 and 22% have sleep apnea, which, by the way, is a tremendous, tremendous number of people. And so why would somebody's throat collapse? Well, sometimes it has to do with their weight, and just the sheer weight of that tissue that's surrounding their neck can have a big issue and literally crush their throat. But more times than not, it has to do with large tonsils, large adenoids. The anatomy in the throat can be blocking. And congestion, significant amounts of congestion, will make it difficult for a patient to breathe through their nose. So then they start breathing through their mouth. And when they breathe through their mouth, they suck their tongue back towards the back of their mouth. And it only has to move a couple millimeters back, and it can fall against the tonsils. And then there you go. You've got a problem on your hands. So what I'm oftentimes...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What I'm oftentimes telling people to do is... to really make sure that, you know, they're looking at ideas surrounding congestion, weight loss, things like that. But that's not how you're going to treat sleep apnea. If you suspect for even a minute that you could have sleep apnea, again, where somebody hears you stop breathing in your sleep, or You're snoring and then waking up gasping or choking for air. Maybe you wake up with a headache in the morning or groggy and grouchy. Talk with your doctor and say that you suspect that you could have sleep apnea, because they can send you for a sleep test. Now, there are two kinds of sleep tests. There are ones where you go to a sleep laboratory and you spend the night. Those are pretty involved. And then there are sleep tests where you can actually do them in your home, right? And so they have these little kits, and they can send them with you to your home. You can evaluate your own sleep process. Then you bring them back in, and a doctor will review them for you, understand exactly what's happening there, and then be able to start giving you recommendations. Now, let's say, as an example, you stop breathing in your sleep between 5 and 15 times an hour. Believe it or not, that's mild sleep apnea, but you have a lot of different options. Options can include anything from a specialized mouth guard that brings your jaw slightly forward to open up your airway, to something called a CPAP machine that stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure. This is like a splint that forms and kind of pushes your throat open while you're wearing a little mask in the evening. A lot of people have these machines. They're very, very successful in treating sleep apnea. And then, of course, there are surgical interventions that people can do. The surgeries can be quite extensive. They can be quite painful, so it's not really my first approach ever. But I do have patients who have had very successful surgeries and are sleeping significantly better because of it.
Right. Removing the tonsils, would that be one of the things that would be included in the surgery?
It very well could be, of course, depending upon the size of the tonsil. But, yes, that's absolutely something that we look at doing for many people. A lot of people don't realize it, but they have large tonsils. And that what we call tonsillar hypertrophy, or a swelling of the tonsils, is what's having the effect of causing this crowding, if you will, inside somebody's throat.
Wow. Boy, this is some serious, serious stuff. Well, how does poor sleep affect us?
Wow.
I mean,
okay,
we get grouchy and concentration and things like that, but it sounds more serious than that.
It is actually more serious than that, and I'm glad you brought that up. And so we know that sleep deprivation, right, and so not getting good quality or good quantity sleep can have a pretty major effect on every organ system, every disease state. So if you're suffering from any medical situation, anyone, it will get worse with bad sleep, okay? So just be aware that you're not doing yourself any favors if you're staying up late when you're not feeling good, because you're not giving your body an opportunity to heal. And that's really what we're looking for, is a healing. Sleep is healing, okay? And so if you're not healing, then your body is continuing to mount up with all of these problems. So number one, if you have a medical problem, it's going to make it worse. But let's say that you're a reasonably healthy individual, but you just don't get a whole lot of sleep, maybe because you don't feel like you have time for sleep, maybe because you've got a busy schedule, or maybe you're just not a great sleeper. Well, we know that sleep also affects your reaction time. So that means if you're driving a vehicle or you're a carpool or you're doing something like that, you could actually be putting people in danger by not being able to get a good night's sleep. We know that emotionally it can have a pretty big effect on you, right? And so we know that people feel their emotions much more strongly when they're sleep-deprived than when they're not sleep-deprived. So anxiety feels worse the more sleep-deprived we are. Depression feels worse the more sleep-deprived we are. Any mental health situation, bipolar disorder, anorexia, you name it, it all gets worse with sleep deprivation. So, again, one of the big things that we're talking about with a lot of people these days is understanding how sleep is that third pillar of health. It really should be a vital sign. You know, it would be great if you could go to the doctor's office and, you know, get your height and your weight and your blood pressure, and then some sort of a sleep score would be fantastic. The problem is it's really hard to metric sleep. You know, like, I know what pounds are, I know what steps are, I know what my blood pressure is, but, you know, how do you decide what your sleep score is? That's a bigger challenge.
Exactly. Well, what does good sleep look like? I mean, is it the same for everyone?
So I always ask people to think, when you're thinking about sleep, don't necessarily think of it as minutes, okay, or hours. Think about it as a quantity issue, but also as a quality issue as well. And so if you can get what the right amount of sleep is for you. And that's going to be different for each person. So 8 hours is a myth. Right? I've been a 6.5 hour sleeper my entire life. My wife needs 8.5. That's just how her body functions. That's just how my body functions. So I go to bed around midnight. I wake up around 6:30, and then that seems to work very well for me. She might go to bed around 11 and get up around 7:30, and that might work really well for her. So understanding how much sleep you need is number one. Number two is doing things throughout your day that can afford you to get a better night's rest. The biggest one is keeping a consistent sleep schedule, so going to bed at the same time, but more importantly, waking up at the same time every single day. And that includes the weekends, you know, so like in the case example of myself, I wake up at 6:30 during the week. I wake up at 6:30 on the weekends because the more consistent my schedule, the better off my body is going to be, would be certainly be step one. Also things to think about are things like caffeine. Many people don't know this, but caffeine has a half-life of between 8 and 10 hours, right? Where half of it stays in the system 8 to 10 hours later. That's a whole lot of stuff there, right? And so you have to think through that. So I ask people to stop drinking caffeine if they can by about 2 p.m. That gives your body a chance to get at least half of it out of your system before you're ready to go to bed. Step number three has to do with alcohol. Now, I don't have a problem if you want to drink wine or beer with dinner, or even a cocktail is fine. But remember, while alcohol may make you feel sleepy, it actually does not allow you to get into the deeper stages of sleep where you're going to actually get better quality sleep. So giving yourself about a 3-hour window before you go to bed. So after the last drink, but before you go to bed is going to be good. So if you go to bed at 11, you want to stop drinking by 8. That will allow your body the opportunity to get rid of that alcohol, metabolize through it so it doesn't have an effect. Next thing is exercise. Exercise, exercise, exercise. There is a significant amount of data to suggest that even exercising as little as 20 minutes a day can, in fact, improve the overall quality of the sleep that you're getting. And so if you can, just 20 minutes a day, even if it's just taking the dog for a walk, that can be enough to allow you to get a better night's rest. And then the final one is sunlight. Everybody should get about 15 minutes of sunlight every single morning. The more time you can spend outside, the better you're going to feel, and the better you're going to sleep. Again, sunlight in the morning time to help kind of get rid of some of that morning fog and get you rolling on your day.
Wow. That's great advice. You know, I didn't think about the sunlight thing because I get, as soon as the sun's up, because I get up at 4 every morning, but as soon as the sun's up, I can hardly wait just to get outside, just to step outside into the sun. And it really does clear that nighttime thing going on. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It almost like it's a wake-up call, and I love this. So what goes on when we sleep? Because I know that, you know, we've talked about the nightmares and, you know, people dream and all this, but there's something else going on. So there are cycles to our sleep. You want to talk to those about those?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So what we now know is that there are distinct cycles to people's sleep, right? And so we know that you go through stage 1, stage 2, stage 3 and 4, and then on into REM sleep. And you do this every single night. And this is important because each one of the stages of sleep does different things to our bodies. As an example, we know that stages 3 and 4 sleep turn out to be the physically restorative sleep. Okay, this is where you get your wake up and feel great sleep. Right? This is where you find it's kind of like bringing your car into the body shop, right? You're going to get all of the dinks and the dents and the things like that pulled out that have happened over the course of the day. REM sleep, the dream sleep, turns out to be your mentally restorative sleep. So this is a sleep where you're moving information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory. This is a time where you're actually creating an organizational structure inside your brain for information that can be very, very important for recall later on. So your problem solving can actually occur during REM sleep. And, I mean, if you think about it, you know, that old adage of I'm going to sleep on it before I make a decision, it turns out to be very accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the other thing to understand is cycles of sleep, right? So we talked about stages, but what we didn't talk about are cycles. So what ends up happening is you go to bed and you fall asleep, and then you go into stage one. And then after stage one, you go to two, then to three and four, back to two and into REM. That whole process takes approximately 90 minutes, and you have approximately five of those cycles. But the sleep is not actually distributed evenly. We know that, in fact, your sleep is distributed unevenly. So the front part of the night, you have more physically restorative sleep, and the back part of the night, you have more mentally restorative sleep. And we think that happens just because the body has to get up in the morning and get going. And so, you know, the brain wants to get the physical stuff out of the way in the early part of the night.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely makes sense. I'm taking notes, actually. This is good
stuff.
Yeah, problem solving. You mentioned that problem solving as part of our sleep cycle. So what about the Alzheimer's patients and the people that have, say they have brain fog from an illness? Is it because they might be missing that part of the sleep cycle?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and we're not 100% sure. We know that lots of people don't sleep well out there. And there's actually been some recent data looking at Alzheimer's and something called sundowner's syndrome. So sundowner's syndrome is a really interesting situation where what we see is that when people are inside all day long, they can't get sunlight. And when they don't get sunlight, especially when they get older and they have Alzheimer's, they become agitated and confused, and it becomes a real problem. So one of the things that people have started experimenting with is light and light therapy for Alzheimer's patients in the early part of the evening. And what they're finding is that it's working very well. So when you look at something like that, we're very interested in how can light therapy become a new part of this whole process.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes perfect sense, because I know that has just got to be awful with the problem solving with certain people. And I wonder if that wouldn't work with chronically ill patients as well. I'm going to have to look into that. Well, what happens when we get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night? Can we pick up where we left off when we climb back into bed?
So yes and no. It all depends upon what you do while going to the bathroom. And I don't mean the going to the bathroom part. I mean whether or not you decide to turn on the lights. If you turn on the lights, you actually tell your brain it's morning, and you end up resetting your brain, and not in a good way. And so that becomes an issue. And so a lot of times I'm explaining to people, if you can just take a strategically placed night light and put it in your bathroom so it can lead you to where you want to go, and then from there you don't have to, you know, turn on lights, you're going to be much better off than if you are turning on the lights in the middle of the night, because that can make it very difficult for you to be able to fall asleep and stay asleep.
Absolutely.
The other thing is many, many people get up in the middle of the night when they actually don't need to. They wake up, and then they say, well, I guess I'm already up. I might as well pee. And as soon as they do that, they've increased their heart rate. So one of the things that most people don't know is that your heart rate is directly tied to your ability to enter into a state of unconsciousness. And so your heart rate has to be lowered, and it's different for every person. But bear with me here. If you can keep your heart rate low, you can then get yourself into a state of unconsciousness. And what happens is that many, many people don't think about this. Their heart rate raises because they've stood up or they've sat up in bed. And so unless you really need to get up, I recommend to people, you know what, lie there and relax. While I can understand that it could be frustrating, remember that about 45 minutes of rest is worth about 15 minutes of sleep from the standpoint of rejuvenation, if you will. So don't worry so much about, am I getting, you know, X number of minutes of sleep, hours of sleep, things like that. But look at it from the perspective of, can I be improving the quality of my sleep? And if I lie here and relax, that can actually be quite helpful.
Awesome. Well, we have a night light in our bathroom, so we're a step ahead. This is good stuff.
There you go. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. I don't believe in turning a bunch of lights on in the middle of the night. What about dehydration? A lot of people are dehydrated. They don't understand how to hydrate. Does that affect our sleep?
It does. So we know, first of all, that as we are breathing at night, right? And so as we breathe, the humidity in our breath, actually we breathe out almost a full liter of water each night. And so we actually wake up dehydrated. And it's amazing to me how many people drink coffee as the first thing that they drink early in the morning. And we know,
right.
by the way, that coffee is a diuretic. So it makes you actually become less hydrated. So one of the first things I'm trying to get people to do is to stop with the coffee in the morning, because quite frankly, it's just not doing anybody any good. So number one, stop drinking coffee as your first thing in the morning. Drink water because you are dehydrated. If you wait approximately 2 hours after you wake up and then have your first cup of coffee, what you will discover is that your coffee, in actuality, will be much more effective from an energy promotion standpoint than if you actually drank it early in the morning, because your cortisol level has begun to drop down. And as your cortisol level begins to drop down, that's when you want the caffeine to help pick it back up again.
Absolutely. I tried this. I heard you on another podcast, and I tried this, and it actually worked. And your coffee tastes better.
It really does. It's amazing,
does.
Isn't it?
It is, and you want less of it through the day, because I am a coffee junkie, and I wanted less. I get up, I drink the water, I drank 16 ounces that morning, and it's like, oh,
wow.
My gosh, this is so great. Yeah, and then about 2-3 hours later, I had my first cup of coffee, which is highly unusual, anybody that knows me, but the coffee tasted so good. I hadn't tasted coffee
so
like
funny.
That forever. And
that's
I wanted
funny.
Less coffee through the day. So it was like,
there
yes, this is a win-win situation. Yes, absolutely. I pay attention to the good speakers, and you're one of them. all right, so I know. I could hardly wait to get you on the show. When I heard you, I can't remember, it was one of the webinars that was going on, and I heard you, and it was the only one I got to listen to out of the entire webinar, and I thought, well, I know why. This is really important. And you want to share with us banana tea? Because I have passed this on
yes.
to everyone. Oh, yes.
So if people are having problems falling asleep or staying asleep at night, one of the things that I want people to try is my recipe for banana tea. Now, people are going to say, okay, Michael, what on earth are you talking about, banana tea? I've never heard of such a thing. So it's very
mm-hmm.
interesting, but most people don't know this, but magnesium, it turns out, has a lot of powerful things to make you fall asleep. And most people don't know that bananas turn out to have a tremendous amount of magnesium. And so, even more interesting, the peel of the banana has three times the amount of magnesium. Now, I know everybody out there is saying, oh my gosh, this guy's going to tell me I have to eat banana peels. No, that's not what I'm going to say. What I am going to say
right.
is, that I've actually developed a recipe for banana tea. So here's what you do is go out and get an organically grown banana. And the reason I say that is because you just want to make sure that there's no pesticides, things like that that could be on it. Wash off all the dirt, cut off the tips, and then cut it in half and leave the fruit in it and the peel on, okay? All of that, right? So once again, you get an organically grown banana, you wash it off, you cut off the tips, you cut it in half, leave the peel and the fruit on. You put it into about 3 cups of boiling water, and you boil it for approximately 4 to 5 minutes or until it starts to turn brown. Once you do that, you then take it out and you steep the water, right? So you pour the water into a glass or a cup, and then you drink the water, okay? You can throw away the banana, although I will tell you this, many of my patients eat the banana too. Because it's nice and soft. But this is delicious. If you like bananas, it has got a ton of magnesium, and you are out like a light.
Absolutely. I know. I just absolutely. And you were talking about melatonin, 1 milligram 90 minutes before bed as well on the webinar.
That's correct.
Yes.
That's correct.
And
so
do you,
when you look
would
at,
you want to do both of those together, like a milligram of melatonin
could,
and the banana tea?
But what, mm-hmm. You could, but what most of my patients tell me is that they don't need to. What most of my patients tell me is one or the other has a tendency to work well for them. I like people trying the banana tea first just to see if that will work for them. And if it will, then I have them, stick with stick with the banana tea if at all possible.
Mm-hmm. And can you do that every single night, or is there
you
some
can.
Kind
that's
of
the beautiful
limit
part
to this?
About banana tea. Well, see, that's the great
right?
part about banana tea is you actually can you drink it every single night. It has no harmful effects, unless I guess you're allergic to bananas. And it's really good for you. Whereas with melatonin, while I don't have a problem with people using it, I do like people to be careful. You know, melatonin is a hormone, and it's by prescription only in many places in Europe. So if you are a regular melatonin user, then number one, what I want you to do is make sure you're having between a half and 1 milligram. That appears to be the appropriate dose based on the science. Number two, what I would say to you is you want to take it between 60 and 90 minutes before lights out. Many people take it like a sleeping pill right at lights out, and that's actually not the most effective way for you to take it. So that's one of the things that I tell people all the time is it's a dosing issue between a half and 1 milligram and then a timing issue, taking it early enough for it to become effective.
Absolutely. And what about, like, Epsom salts, baths, and things like that? Do you find that that's useful for sleep?
I do, as a matter of fact. One of the things, especially for my patients who have sleep and pain issues, because many people do have these sleep and pain issues, and they have to be addressed, right? And so when you look at a group of people, Epsom salt has been well known to be a muscle relaxant, and that can be highly effective for people. So in many cases, I'm telling people, hey, look, do me a favor. Just try an Epsom salt bath and see what happens. You might very well be surprised. And many of them now actually come with lavender as a fragrance to them, and that can even make it even more powerful.
Yes. I think you're reading my mind because lavender was next on my list of here to talk about. So lavender, I know. But, you know, I tell a lot of people, put lavender essential oil on your pillow, inside your pillowcase, and that actually helps as well.
It does.
Or lavender tea, actually, yeah. So
yeah,
there are a lot
lavender
of good things out there to help us.
Lavender turns out to be very interesting. There's actually a double-blind, placebo-controlled study showing that lavender can be effective for helping people feel a relaxation effect. And that relaxation is what's causing people to fall asleep at night.
Right. But staying asleep is another thing. So can we address
it
that?
It can be, yeah.
You know,
certainly.
Yeah. I see patients that actually they'll get 2.5 hours of sleep, and then they're wide awake. Wide awake. What do people do in that situation when they get 2.5, maybe even up to 4 hours of sleep, and then they're wide awake, have trouble getting back to sleep?
So first of all, it's more common than you might imagine. That's, believe it or not, the most common form of insomnia is the inability to stay asleep, which is what you're talking about. And so there's a couple of different things to think about. So number one, believe it or not, this is going to sound crazy, but many of my patients who report these kind of sleep problems actually go to bed too early. I know that sounds very counterintuitive, right? So you're telling me that patients who wake up in the middle of the night are actually going to bed too early. It actually happens that way. Many people, they just get so doggone frustrated, right? They're thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm never going to fall asleep. I'm going to get to bed early in the hopes that I will be able to fall asleep. And the fact of the matter is all that does is while they may fall asleep, it will make them wake up much earlier. So in many cases, I'm actually asking people to stay up later than they normally would, and that can actually be a big help. But if you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night on a fairly regular basis, number one, it might not be a bad idea to try this banana tea or melatonin, because both of those can help keep you sleeping through the night. But number two is maybe even talking with your doctor, because you could have a blood sugar issue. It's very interesting work that's been recently been done where I've discovered that, in fact, people with inconsistent blood sugar, so spikes in blood sugar, can actually wake them up in the middle of the night. And they may not be hungry or thirsty. They just wake up in the middle of the night, and they don't know why. So watching your blood sugar and maintaining that level blood sugar by not having your biggest meal of the day in the evening will actually be very, very helpful in keeping you asleep at night. Your biggest meal of the day should be breakfast, followed by lunch, and then your smallest meal of the day should be dinner.
Right. And in the European countries, usually lunch is the big meal.
Exactly.
You know, yes, like Germany and stuff, they have theirs at lunchtime. What about blood pressure and sleeping?
So it's interesting is people with normal blood pressure, their blood pressure will drop when they go to sleep. People with abnormal blood pressure, so not normal blood pressure, their blood pressure does not drop when they sleep. They're what we call our non-dippers. So there are people whose blood pressure dips, and there's people whose blood pressure doesn't dip. We know that the non-dippers, these people with high blood pressure already, this can be a big issue because their heart never really kind of catches a break here. Their heart is constantly going, going, going. Their blood pressure stays high, and that in and of itself can be a big problem for them. So speaking with your doctor and understanding more about what your blood pressure issues are can, in fact, also affect your sleep and maybe make you sleep a little bit better. So if you're one of those people that has a tendency to have slightly high blood pressure, talk with your doctor also about your sleep.
Wow. This is awesome stuff. Because I know that there are a lot of people listening that they wanted me to mention blood pressure and some other things. So we've done that. And then you have answered beautifully. What about, we were talking about sugar, but you said carbs, good carbs, can actually help you sleep. So what kind of things should people be eating if they want to use food to get to sleep?
Right. So it has to be restrictive, okay? And so you're talking about a 250 calorie snack. You're not talking about anything big here, because a lot of people have a tendency to say, oh, well, Dr. Bruce said I need carbs before bed, so you know I'm going to eat a chocolate cake, okay? That's not. I repeat, that is not what I am suggesting. What I am suggesting is something like maybe an apple with some sort of a nut butter, like an almond butter or something like that, could actually be very good because you've got enough protein and enough good carbohydrates to actually make a difference for yourself. But again, being careful, a bowl of non-sugar cereal could actually be a great way to get a little bit of extra carbohydrates before bed, keep you from being hungry before bed, because by the way, people who are falling asleep while hungry, that they have a much more difficult time sleeping than people who are going to sleep when they're not hungry.
Right.
And even cheese and crackers can actually be a good snack right before bed. But again, keep it under 250 calories, and please be careful because that's an easy way to put on weight, and you just really want to make sure that you're not doing something that could be against your health goals while you're trying to fall asleep.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Do you have a takeaway message for people listening?
Well, I do have a new book out, and I'd love to tell people a little bit about my new book. It's called The Power of When, W-H-E-N. And the reason it's called that is because what I have discovered is that timing of certain things throughout your day based on your sleep at night can actually turn out to be a very healthy process. And so it turns out that people have these things called chronotypes. Now, people have heard of these before, like early bird and night owl. Those are chronotypes. And I've discovered that there are actually four of these chronotypes. And by understanding these four chronotypes, I can actually tell people what the perfect time of day is to eat a cheeseburger, have sex, run a mile, ask their boss for a raise, you name it. So, in essence, you can go to my website called thepowerofwhenquiz.com and take a quiz, learn your chronotype, and then from there, if you decide to get the book, you can learn when to do just about anything at the right time.
Absolutely. And for more information on Dr. Michael here, it's www.thesleepdoctor.com. Powerhouse, just a powerhouse, just wonderful information. And I thank you so much for being here today. I know that you are a busy, busy person.
Well, thank you for having me. I was excited to be on your show, and I'm happy to come back whenever you want.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're trying to arrange for you to come to the Physicians Roundtable Conference. I'm working with your assistant there. And I think that everyone, people come from all over the world to the Physicians Roundtable Conference. So I'm sure that everyone would absolutely benefit. So I'm working with her, and I hope to see you there. Thank you so much,
awesome,
Dr. Bruce.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Day.
Yes, you too, everyone. Have a great sleep. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.